The following is the second lecture in the series on Rav Kook, this one entitled Israel, Land and Religion, given at the Jewish Center on Sunday, November the 10th, 1963. I confess to being a bit uncertain and a bit perplexed before I begin tonight. I'll have to tell you something very, very personal that happened yesterday, and that will explain to you why I feel so uncertain. My oldest daughter visited a friend, and she was there for the Shabbos meal, and Saturday night, the friend called back Mrs. Lamb and said, "Something interesting happened today. I asked your daughter how everyone is, and she said, fine. And then she said, except for my father. And I said to her, why? What's wrong with your father? And she said, well, he's very nervous because tomorrow he has to lecture on Rav Kook and he doesn't know what he's going to say." I'm beginning to wonder, maybe I really don't know what I'm going to say. Like the speaker who said, before I speak, I want to say something. Before I begin the substance of my lecture, I want to add something to what I should, something that I should have said last time. Several people asked me after the lecture about the family of Rav Kook. I had mentioned that he was born in the mid-1800s and died in 1935, and his whole biography of this great chief rabbi who was so beloved and so profound a thinker, and I mentioned very little about his family. Let me say, therefore, that he has one daughter who survives today from his first wife. He was married the first time to the daughter of the Aderes, who was previously chief rabbi of Jerusalem. He has one daughter from her, who is now married to Rabbi Shalom Rabinowitz of Jerusalem. From his second wife, he has his only son, Rabbi Tzvi Yehuda Kook, whom some of you may have visited in Yerushalayim, who is head of the Merkaz HaRav Kook, the great yeshiva. He has a daughter married to his son-in-law, Rabbi Ra'anan Kook, a very distinguished scholar. And he had a daughter from the second wife who was killed at the age of 11 by a fall. This makes up the family of Rav Kook. Tonight's lecture is, in a sense, a love story. When I say love, I don't mean that commodity that is sold and bandied about so cheaply in modern America and modern civilization, which an American humorist, who I think was quite a profound philosopher, Ambrose Bierce, he once defined love as a temporary insanity curable by marriage. This is not the kind of love story we're speaking about today. We are speaking rather of a story of three great loves in the life of Rav Kook, and not only in the life, but in the teaching of the Rav. And that is Ahavas Eretz Yisrael, the love of the land of Israel, the Holy Land. Ahavas Yisrael, the love of Israel, meaning the people of Israel. And Ahavas Hashem, the love of God. These are the three loves we speak of. The love of the Holy Land, the people of Israel, and the God of Israel. Let us begin with the first, the love of the Holy Land. To understand the contribution of Rav Kook to the thought of the time, you must know something about the background. This was the era when the emancipation was coming into Eastern Europe, the idea of giving Jews their civil rights, and the concomitant reaction on the part of many Jews that it's time to break down the walls of the ghetto. And breaking down the walls of the ghetto was interpreted as throwing out the Torah, the tradition that we once had, and adopting not only the ideals but also the mores of the surrounding civilization. And so there developed two factions amongst the Jews of Russia. There were the Maskilim. The Maskilim means the enlightened ones, those who wanted to assimilate, those who wanted to overthrow orthodoxy, and those who remained orthodox or true to the Jewish tradition. The Maskilim generally in Russia were Hebrew-speaking. They substituted for the Torah, for the tradition, the Hebrew language and the secular culture of our people. Yet they found, after a while, that they had gone too far. Even a man like Yehuda Leib Gordon, who had recommended to his followers, be a Jew indoors, but a man outdoors, as if being a human being and being a Jew were two contradictory theses, even he, towards the end of his life, bemoaned the fact that a language alone cannot hold a people alive, because he saw that as a result of his Haskalah, that many of the people who followed him had decided to take a shorter shortcut and had intermarried and even converted as a means of winning their way into the larger Russian civilization. Many of these people became bitterly disappointed. You know, we Jews have a habit of being overly grateful at times. Gratitude is a wonderful midah, a wonderful characteristic. But sometime if someone does us a favor as a people, we respond with a sense of worship, with a sense of euphoria. I don't want to talk about current events, but I think it's something we ought to keep in mind these last couple of days as well. Not to respond too quickly until we've investigated what we have. In the 1850s, late 1850s and early 1860s, the Tsar of Russia, Alexander II, decided to start giving civil liberties to the Jews. And the response was a tremendous gratitude on the part of the Maskilim, the birth of the movement, and the desire to say that we want to have Russification. We want to become Russians like all Russians, in imitation of the Germans, who wanted to become simply Germans of Mosaic persuasion. They went, they did it, and then they were bitterly disappointed. The disappointing event took place in 1871, when a tremendous pogrom, by the standards of that time, today it would be nothing for the people who have lived through the Hitler era, when a tremendous pogrom broke out in Odessa, many, many Jews were killed and tortured, and the Jews discovered that the Russian government had a hand in it. The Russian government that Jews wanted to accept as their very own, the Russian civilization that Jews wanted to adhere to and become naturalized into. This same Russian government and civilization had instigated, initiated, fomented, and supported that bloody pogrom. Well, this had a tremendous effect upon the Maskilim of the time. It gave them a feeling of disappointment in the great philosophy of progress, you know, that the 19th century was based upon the idea that progress must inevitably come, and that with the course of time, mankind must go higher and higher. Reform was built on the philosophy of progress. As a matter of fact, in the 1890s, one of the founders of Reform was able to write that we have now entered in the era of universal justice and peace, when wars will no longer be possible. That was before the turn of this century, and the century itself has proven how false this philosophy of progress is. But in Russia, the Maskilim saw in 1871 that the philosophy of inevitable progress, the philosophy of trying to assimilate to the Russian environment, to the culture of the West, had experienced a terrible bankruptcy. And so there was a spirit of tshuva, of repentance, and the university students of Vienna and Jewish students who went to study in Vienna were known to be the ferment, the cream of those who were heretics and were willing to overthrow our religious tradition. They were the pioneers of the assimilationists. That after this event, hundreds of them wrote back to Eastern Europe asking that they be sent pairs of tefillin, because they experienced this crisis within and therefore wanted to return. And a man like Lilium Blum, one of the greatest of all the Maskilim, was able to speak of the bankruptcy of humanism and the need to return to Torah and mitzvahs. During this time, it was not a return so much to Torah, although it was that too, but it started to express itself in a turn towards nationalism. We have to keep in mind that we are one people, that we are one nation, and that we shall not find our Yeshua, we shall not find our salvation by becoming a Russian with the Russians and a German with the Germans and a Frenchman with the Frenchmen, but rather we have to return to the land of Israel. what then was called Palestine. This was the time that the Chibat Zion, the movement of the lovers of Zion, the Chovavei Zion, the forerunners of modern Zionism, came into being. This was the era of Theodor Herzl and the first Zionist Congress in 1897. It was a time when nationalism, Jewish nationalism, and Jewish religion developed side by side without any great antagonism. But then there came a thinker, a very important thinker, who wrote by the pen name of Achad Ha'am. His name was Ginsberg, but he is known as Achad Ha'am. Achad Ha'am, and to give his theory, of course, is much too difficult within the confines of a few moments of background. Essentially, he said that nationalism or Zionism should not go with Torah, but it must supplant Torah. It comes instead of Torah. That the Jews must now look to the essence of Torah, which he called ethics, the Musar HaYadus, the Torah Shebalev, the inner Torah, and salvage that, throw away the mitzvahs, throw away Jewish observances, and go only for the core. And therefore he developed a nationalism which was form, which emphasized the nationalistic elements and discarded everything else. The negative effects of Achad Ha'amism are noticeable to this day. By negative effects, I mean that if nationalism is the goal which we set ourselves, then once you have a nation and once you have a homeland, what else is there? And the crisis that is being suffered by the citizenry of Israel today, that this is a nation created by idealism, and now they have nothing because their ideals have been fulfilled so quickly, this actually was prepared, its successes and its failures, by Achad Ha'am. How did Orthodoxy react to this secular Zionism, to this attempt to supplant Torah with a nationalistic spirit in that time? It must be understood that the love of the Holy Land, the love of nation, is part and parcel of our religious tradition. Every time in our history we have had a revival of piety throughout the ages, it always had with it the element of aliyah, of return to the Holy Land. Some of the most pious always expressed their new piety, their revival of piety, by going to the Holy Land. It is a part of Torah. In a practical or programmatic sense, it took the form of an organized movement by people like Kalischer and Guttmacher, who preached in Europe the idea that the settlement of Palestine is a precondition for the coming of Mashiach, or the Messiah. That unless the Jews first settle the Holy Land, Mashiach will not come. And therefore we must return to the Holy Land by ourselves and build it up. So that Zionism became not a substitute for Messianism, the belief in Mashiach, but a preparation for it. We return to the Holy Land because this is the way we begin to fulfill the complete Torah which we have inherited. There were other people who were important in that time. Rabbis like Rhinus and Molliver, Shmuel Molliver, who combined to found the Mizrahi movement, which maintained that although we differ with the secular Zionists in the sense that we want to keep the Torah, want to have a Torah-directed nation or country, we work with them, however, in trying to achieve the Zionist goal of restoring the homeland. This was one reaction of Orthodoxy, to work with the Zionists, although we differ with them on principles. Then there was another group that was the Orthodox opposition to Zionism, who maintained that because the Zionists are secularists, because Zionism is supported and led by people who themselves are non-observant and in many cases anti-religious, therefore we shall have no truck with practical political Zionism. We shall wait for the Mashiach to come. We will not go and build now and try to anticipate what belongs solely in the divine realm. This party, this also became crystallized as a party, and this was the Agudas Yisrael, the Agudas Israel. The Aguda then was headed by many of the great Hasidic teachers, and especially by a man we mentioned at the last lecture, the sainted Rabbi Yisrael Meir HaKohen, known as the Chofetz Chaim. Now to Rav Kook. Rav Kook had a major contribution to make in the theory of nationalism. He maintained that Jewish nationalism, this drang, this urging, this inclination or inner drive to weld ourselves into one unbroken people, one indivisible nation, in the Holy Land, on the sacred soil of our people, that this nationalism is an expression of the divine endowment of the Jewish soul. The Jewish soul is a divine one. It is given by God. And part of it, part of the expression of that neshama, that is neshama ha-Yisraelit, that Jewish soul, is the idea of nationalism, the idea of working with, together with all other Jews towards returning to Zion. Therefore, even people like Achad Ha'am, or his even more radical disciple, Joseph Micha Berdachevsky, who was a neo-pagan, who believed only in brute strength, Jews must return to brute strength, and forget everything, he was influenced by Nietzsche. Even people of this sort, as long as they preached and practiced and worked towards returning to the Holy Land, towards seeing a basic unity amongst the Jewish people, then although they didn't even recognize that there's a God in the world, they were carrying out the will of God. Remarkably, they were doing God's work in the world, although they didn't realize it and perhaps didn't even know that there is a God. Later we shall see that Rav Kook based this to a great extent upon his idea that the Jew is naturally a religious being. In his natural, healthy state, a Jew is a religious being. Therefore, if a Jew is naturally religious, then atheism or agnosticism is what? A sickness. It's a psychic aberration, a temporary insanity. If agnosticism or atheism, apikoresis, is a sickness, then it means that whatever helps one to overcome that illness is a positive good. Now, if there is no nationalism, if there is no unity amongst the Jewish people, then the man who is an unbeliever must assimilate. He has no choice. We see it about ourselves today, do we not? People who are not bound to Israel and are not bound to Torah intermarry and we lose sight of them. They are lost to the Jewish people. But people who are welded as a nation, then even though now they are not religious, but the very fact that this is a condition which leads to a return later on, it keeps them within the fold so that they can return. Therefore, nationalism becomes a positive good within the economy, within the whole framework and the whole plan of God for the Jewish people. Rav Kook, as I mentioned last time, and we'll have a chance to expand on it much more next week, please God, in a completely different framework. Rav Kook was a Kabbalist. He was a mystic. He took Jewish mysticism or Kabbalah very seriously. He himself was an immensely creative mekubal or mystic. Do you remember the song that we all sang as children? Kutcha brichu Yisrael v'yaraisa achadhu. That God, Israel, and Torah are one. This is a phrase from the Zohar, the source book of the Kabbalah or Jewish mysticism. God, Israel, and Torah are one. Together they constitute a unity. That means, said Rav Kook, that the way to God, well, if you have one thing which is a unity, let's say I am one person, but I have two hands. Now, the way to get me is to grab me by either hand. Whichever hand you grab me by, you'll then be able to get the rest of me. If God, Torah, and Israel are a unity, then the way to God can come either through Torah or through Israel. Either one will lead you into the unity. If you go through Torah, then through Torah you will be bound to the Jewish people because you enter into one unity. If I start through Israel, then by associating myself with the Jewish people in an active, intensive fashion, I enter into a unity. Therefore, I have Torah in God sooner or later. It's merely a conduit. It merely leads me in to the sacred unity of these three. So that here, too, we found a mystic element showing the importance of nationalism as such. Let's get an idea of what Rav Kook himself says about it, in case you don't believe me. Page 7. In the middle of the page, number 1. Any volunteer to read? All right.
what these nationalists really want, they themselves do not know. So powerfully united is the spirit of Israel to the spirit of God, that even the one who says that he has nothing to do with the spirit of God, the moment that he admits he desires to share in the spirit of Israel, then the divine spirit enters into the inwardness of his aspiration, even despite itself. An individual may tear himself apart from the source of life. Not so the nation, the whole congregation of Israel. Therefore, all the possessions that are dear to the nation on account of the national spirit are suffused with the indwelling spirit of God, its land, its language, its history, its customs.
Ah, so here you see it again. The Jewish people by nature participates in this oneness with God, therefore an individual Jew can be lost. He can be lost. Through assimilation, through simply cutting off all bonds with our people, he is lost. But the whole congregation of Israel, the whole community or collectivity, can't, because by its very nature, it is bound to God. Rav Kook, therefore, was, as I said, a strong nationalist. That is why he believed that Jews must relearn skills they had long forgotten, agricultural skills, scientific skills. Insofar as secular education, that's a complete problem, which we'll again discuss next week. He was able to interpret the Torah as such, many of the most important mitzvos, as being of nationalistic importance. Kashrus and Shabbos, Pesach and Sukkos keep the Jews welded together as one people, and the very fact that they are one people leads them back to God. Shabbos, what is Shabbos? It's Me'ein Olam Haba, as we say in one of our Zmiros. It's a foretaste of the world to come. It's a kind of anticipation of the days of the Messiah, of Mashiach, which will bring universal peace and brotherhood. That's why Shabbos is a time of Shalom, Shabbat Shalom, and a time of friendliness of one Jew for another. He was able to see in all the Torah the importance of the love of Eretz Yisrael, the love of nationalism. And he developed this into in a very philosophical way too. To give you the gist of it, Rav Kook maintained that in the life of any collectivity, any community, any people, in the beginning, nationalism or community consciousness and religion are identical. Any primitive group begins that way. They have one faith and one nation. As time goes on, a split appears, and both elements begin to diverge. And there is, I'm using a modern term, but I don't mean it in that sense, a separation of church and state. The nationalist element, the governmental element, the community awareness of the people goes in one direction, the religious development goes in another, so that it is possible for one to subscribe to the faith but not be a part of the people, or be a part of the people but not subscribe to the faith. Although this is a natural development, Rav Kook maintained that it's an unhealthy one. That while the two must develop, perhaps independently for a while, but they must never diverge completely. Because if religion is not accompanied by a healthy national will to live, it becomes otherworldly. It loses contact with men. It becomes a matter of monasticism and asceticism. It becomes merely a theological exercise for the few. It has no relation to real life. And on the other hand, and we've seen both things in our own day, nationalism that continues to grow without the accompanying spiritual life has a tendency to degenerate into jingoism, into collective self-worship. A nation believes not in God, but in itself, and therefore it begins to enshrine and enthrone the nation, the state, in place of God, so that what you have in Russia, for instance, is a worship of the state as such. Statism is a form of religion. Those of you who want proof, try to remember to the 70th birthday of Oso HaRussia, of Stalin. And you remember the tributes paid to him by communist leaders throughout the country, including, unfortunately, many Yiddish writers who were devout communists. They praised him as, they called him everything but God. He is beyond, transcends human reason, beyond the gaze of mere mortals. Because nationalism, when divorced from religion, becomes a religion. It becomes idolatry. Therefore, the healthy thing is for both to go together. And especially with the Jewish people, they must both come together again. the willingness, the desire to be with Jews, to love the land, and the desire to love God, or rather the desire for the Torah and for the spiritual life of Israel. These ideas were written by Rav Kook in a very long and important essay entitled The Mission of Israel and Its Nationhood, in translation, in the year 1901. It penetrated many yeshivos. It made a tremendous, had a tremendous reaction in Orthodox circles. So powerful was the reaction that within 1 year, the Mizrahi was founded as a response to it. Rav Kook became a godfather, as it were, to the Mizrahi, but interestingly, he never joined the organization. He held himself above and beyond politics, and he was equally friendly to the Mizrahi, to the Aguda, to what later became the Mapai or the Histadrut. His sympathies, of course, lay with the Mizrahi, no question. But as an individual, as a Rav, he kept beyond all politics and above it all. I mentioned his writings. I might add that they were tremendous. I don't know if I mentioned it last time, but there's an immense amount of unpublished works by Rav Kook, over 30 volumes, if they were printed. If you've ever seen a big Shas Gemara, there are 30 such volumes of manuscript in only one of his books, called the Be'er HaHalacha, his halachic work, of which only a slim volume on Kedushin was published. This is a tremendous legal achievement. Rav Kook used to say that he writes this book, this Sefer, only as a form of relaxation from his higher mystical work. In the same way, Lahavdil, that Immanuel Kant, the great German philosopher, used to say that when his mind tires of philosophy, he works at mathematics. And Rav Kook's mind worked very quickly. He used to write at a tremendous, tremendous speed, and when his hand became tired, he put it down, took the pen in his left hand, and began to write again. He trained himself to become ambidextrous so as not to lose the thoughts that gushed out of his mind. A tremendously creative fountain. And of course, he had a personal love for Eretz Yisrael. In addition to this theoretical love, there was a personal love. He would say that when he left the Holy Land, he felt a sense of physical distress, of physical anguish. And when he was in Eretz Yisrael, those inner wells of creativity would open up and gush forth. And when he was out of the country, he felt that they began to dry and shrivel on him, and that he could not create as well as he could in the holy atmosphere of the Holy Land. Thus far for his theory of the love of the land of Israel. How about the love of Israel as such? Let me go to origins, where he gets this love of Israel as well as love of Eretz Israel. I have my own theory. If you recall, I mentioned that Rav Kook's family had roots both in the Hasidic movement, especially in the Chabad, Lubavitch, and also amongst the Misnagdim, the opponents to the Hasidim, especially in the area of Volozhin, Lithuania. You know, the difference between them was once explained by a certain rabbi as follows. The Talmud tells in its Agada, legend so-called, that Yonasan ben Aziel, one of the great rabbis, was such a holy man that when he studied Torah, if a bird would fly overhead, it would burn up. Now, the difference between a chassid and a misnagid is this. The misnagid, the chassid, with his emotional and ecstatic approach, would say, "What a holy man! I wish I could have that kind of kedusha." How does he do it? The misnagid, with his shrewd, legalistic frame of thinking, would say, "Well, if Yonasan ben Aziel was studying, and because of his studies, a bird flew overhead and was burnt up, who has to pay for the bird if it belonged to somebody?" It's a very practical, down-to-earth, halachic, legalistic frame of mind. Well, for the Misnagdim, the love of Eretz Yisrael was important because it was a halacha. It was a basic principle, one of the mitzvahs. And therefore, the Misnagdim did do a great deal towards developing the Holy Land. The Gaon of Vilna himself, and he was the leader of the Misnagdic movement, the creator of Lithuanian scholarship, the Gaon of Vilna himself went to the Holy Land, that is, he went towards the Holy Land, but for some reason obscure and mysterious to historians, he turned back at the last minute. But we have the letters that he wrote to his mother and his wife when he left them to go to the Holy Land to build his home there. One of his students, Rabbi Yisrael of Shklov, went and actually founded colonies in Jerusalem and most of what today is the Batei Ashta, Batei HaPerushim in Tzfas, the special neighborhoods of Tzfas. Therefore, they did build the Holy Land, and they had Ahavas Eretz Yisrael as part of this tradition. I have no doubt that although the Hasidim also had tremendous Ahavas Eretz Yisrael, but the special attachment to the land came from his Misnagdic background or was reinforced by it. On the other hand, the Hasidim had a tremendous fraternal love. They emphasized Ahavas Yisrael, Libhov Naiden, just to love a Jew. This love of fellow Jew, love of fellow man, was a tremendous force in the Hasidic movement. In fact, it was part of the whole social doctrine of the Hasidic movement. For instance, Hasidim say that when the Kohanim give their priestly benediction, their Birchas Kohanim Yivarechecha, they make a blessing first. The blessing is Asher Kedeshanu B'mitzvosav V'tzivanu L'vareich Es Amo Yisrael B'Ahava. He has commanded us to bless his people Israel in love. The literal meaning is that we should, with love, bless the people of Israel. Hasidim say no. He has commanded us to bless the children of Israel. What is the blessing? Be ahava, that they should learn to love each other. The greatest blessing is that Jews should love each other. And Hasidim tell the story of two of the great tzaddikim of the movement who were walking along in silence and meditating, and suddenly one took out a pack of cigarettes or snuff box, whatever was in vogue then, and said, "Here." The other man took it and said, "I just needed it at that moment. How did you know?" He said, "Look, if I am hungry, how does my hand know to take food and put it into my mouth? Because we're part of the same body. If we really love each other, then I know every pain of your body, every want and every desire." Ahavas Yisrael was an important doctrine, one of the chief doctrines of the Hasidic movement, and one that guaranteed its success, especially in the early years. Now, let me say this, that Ahavas Yisrael for Rav Kook was an emotion, but it was far, far more than that. It was more than a sweet sentimentalism of a fine old Rav, because Rav Kook was anything but a fine old Rav. He was a giant, a mental giant and a spiritual giant. And for him, the love of Israel was a complex intellectual and religious doctrine. I have before me a book recently published in Israel of 108 pages of small type, published by Moshe Rav Kook, the publishing house under his name, Hasanagoria B'Mishnat Rav Kook, by Binyamin Efrati. Hasanagoria means the defense, the advocacy, or another way of saying Ahavas Yisrael, the doctrine of the love of Israel in the philosophy, as it were, of Rav Kook. And he points out that it's a very intricate and complicated doctrine, and it's not at all as simple as we might imagine. There's a difference, for instance, according to Rav Kook, between an ordinary Jew's love of his fellow Jew and the special Ahavas Yisrael of the Tzaddik, one who has reached a higher spiritual rung. He discusses the problem not only of how to express love, but how to go into battle against a fellow Jew. A fellow Jew disagrees with me. He completely rejects God and Torah. I am going to engage him in debate and dialogue and controversy. Well, if you have Ahavas Yisrael, you do it in a certain way. If you have no love of fellow Jew, you do it in another way. And therefore, one must even know how to do battle against a fellow Jew if he is going to live in the framework of Ahavas Yisrael. Some of his major emphases in this doctrine are, first of all, that he doesn't preach tolerance. Tolerance is a very empty word, especially amongst so much of our own class throughout the country or throughout the world. All too often, tolerance, and I'm not speaking merely about the fact that it's patronizing, I tolerate somebody, let's forget about that aspect of it. But tolerance often is a substitute for not having any real convictions of your own. For instance, I can very well tolerate jazz, because I'm not that well acquainted or have no strong opinions about music. I can very well tolerate cubism, for instance. As a matter of fact, whether I do or not is beside the point. But if I have no opinions, if I have no convictions, I'm very tolerant. Economic theories, you can sell me anything you want. I have no convictions of any strength. Well, this is not really tolerance. This merely means I don't care. For of Cook, this kind of tolerance was absolutely irrelevant and of no concern to him. His kind of tolerance was a man should believe in a thing heart and soul and stake his life on it and believe that this is it and there is nothing else, and yet be able to engage someone who opposed them on these principles, man to man, without denying the other person's dignity and self-respect. This was the kind of tolerance that he wanted. He said, you ought to do battle with someone else. Engage him in controversy. But the principle must be chesed, love, graciousness. Do battle, but always with dignity and respect for the other person. Never cut off all communications with him. Because above all, you must remember that there is a purpose to this controversy. What is the purpose of the controversy or the dialogue, the encounter between religious and non-religious? What would it be in Rav Kook's framework? Tshuva. If I have no interest in bringing him around to a higher point of view and therefore to seeing things in a greater light, then why bother? Then my controversy is merely a personal attack, and that is disgraceful. I must never attack anyone personally. Therefore, the whole reason for my engaging him in controversy is teshuva, to bring him around to repentance. And this can never be achieved in acrimony, in anger, or in any kind of personal, insolent manner. Rav Kook, therefore, had a very high opinion of the modern generation. This is a terrible thing to say, isn't it? We all complain, not only when we're religious and see irreligion, but as we get older, we reach a certain age level, the tendency automatically becomes to criticize the younger generation. It's a symbol, I think, of youthfulness. To test, if you want to test your youthfulness, see what you think of the younger generation. If you say, oh, they're not what we used to be, it means you're getting old. If you can justify them and see something good in them, you're still young. Rav Kook had a great deal of good that he saw in the young modern generation that was growing up in the Holy Land. By young modern generation, I mean young idealistic workers who had scrapped Torah and religion. And yet he saw a great deal of good. Two reasons. First, he appreciated, because he saw it firsthand, their tremendous idealism. Look at page 10. Number 3. Our present generation is a wonderful one. A generation that is altogether amazing. It's difficult to find another like it in all our history. It consists of many opposites, light and darkness coexisting in it. It is lowly and despicable, yet elevated and lofty, altogether guilty and altogether innocent. It is a strange generation, mischievous and wild, yet exalted and noble. You find on the one hand increasing chutzpah, the son unashamed before his father, youngsters insulting their elders. And on the other hand, charity, decency, justice, and compassion gaining strength, idealistic and intellectual power breaking out and ascending. A generation of this kind, ready to meet death bravely because of goals it considers worthy, often solely on account of inner feelings of righteousness and justice, cannot be considered lowly, even if its goals are all wrong. This is a very mature insight into a very paradoxical kind of generation that was ready to commit martyrdom on behalf of its ideals, although one did not necessarily agree with those ideals. Rav Kook used to have a special interpretation of the verse you recognize from the Av HaRachamim, V'chiper admoso amo. We normally interpret that as if it were V'chiper admoso v'amo. God will forgive, expiate the sins of his land and his people. And the Rav used to say, not that way, but V'chiper admoso amo. The soil of Israel itself is a kapara, an expiation, a forgiveness for the sins of his people. If a Jew comes and lives and thrives and helps build the Holy Land, then the Holy Land itself forgives him his other sins. Well, this was a radical opinion for an Orthodox rabbi, especially the chief rabbi of Jerusalem and the chief rabbi of all Palestine, and he suffered terribly because of it. He was attacked wildly. The zealots, the Kanoim, which means both the moderates of the Aguda and the extremists of what became later the Natura Carta, never gave him peace. In the beginning, the two aged leaders of the zealot group, the Kanoim, very revered, saintly sages. We mentioned last week one of them, Rabbi Yosef Chaim Zonnenfeld and Rabbi Yitzchak Yeruchim Diskin. Both of them very great people, were very friendly to Rav Kook. And when Rav Kook came, they came to pay him his respect, their respects, and he returned the courteous gesture. But as always happens, the underlings create all the trouble. And there were underlings who had neither the breadth of vision, nor the scholarship, nor the piety or saintliness of Rabbi Zonnenfeld and Diskin. And they believed that the end justifies the means, and they began to tell Rabbi Zonnenfeld and Rabbi Diskin all kinds of vicious lies about Rav Kook. They defamed him. They said things about him which were utterly wild. They created a mood of distrust against him amongst the pious of Jerusalem. They wrote leaflets against him. They took parts of his works out of context. And the popular sport of Yerushalayim became to denounce Rav Kook as a heretic. They were to hound him throughout life. They never recognized him as chief rabbi and referred to him as the rabbi of Jaffa. And the day that he was elected chief rabbi, these people declared a fast because they regarded it as a national tragedy. I have no doubt that Rav Kook's opinions would have been quite clear for the events of the recent weeks. Events, I'm sure that he never would have agreed to stone throwing, no matter what the provocations, and there are plenty of provocations, but he never would have agreed to this kind of policy. This is not the way one engages in religious controversy. And reverse swastikas for these young fools who did it would have galled him and enraged him beyond question. Sometimes I think to myself that, all right, their expressed conscious motives of such people are sincere, but I wonder what the unconscious motives are. It always reminds me of the story of the man who succumbed to temptation, and he partook of a morsel of tray food, and his conscience bothered him. And he came to his rabbi and said, I did a terrible thing, chageges nechaza. Tell me, how can I do tshuva? How can I repent? So the rabbi said, for a month's time, you must come to daven with a minyan every morning, and you must make sure to say two kapitlach tilim. Well, he did it. He came to shul the first day, and he was saying his two kapitlach tilim, and behind him, he noticed a man with long payas and a long beard, very mystical and saintly looking, very frum, and saying tilim at the rate of a mile a minute, at least 10 chapters while he said his two. So he thought to himself, he says, it's amazing, such a pious looking man. If I, for one little piece of tray food, had to say two kapitlach tilim, he's saying so much tilim. I always suspect people who throw stones and act in this kind of zealous manner that inside they seem to feel that they've done something wrong. Rav Kook wrote a book called Oros. Difficult to read, difficult to understand, because it's written in a poetic, semi-mystical manner, but in which he gave his greatest doctrine of seeing a positive value, a positive religious value. He's not speaking as a politician. A positive religious value in the irreligious who helped to build the Holy Land. This enraged his opponents, and they sent sections of it to all European rabbis. They added fictitious reports, and the report came about, abounded in Europe, that this new chief rabbi of the Holy Land must be a kind of reform rabbi. This was the kind of impression created about him. He was defended, of course, by his students, especially Rabbi Yaakov Moshe Chalap, a very, very important and great disciple of the Rav. But an interesting thing happened. In Shushan Purim of 1921, the great Gera Rebbe, one of the greatest of the Hasidic Rebbes of all of Poland, went with a large company of other Rebbes and Hasidim on a trip to the Holy Land. As soon as they came, they paid their first visit to the Kosel Maharavi, the Wailing Wall, you know, the only wall that remains of the temple, which today is out of bounds for Jews. And as soon as he finished, he turned around to his people and said, "Nun jetzt wollen wir gehen zu Rav Kook. Now we're going to go to pay our respects to the rabbi." When the zealots heard this, they were crestfallen. They thought that they had succeeded in blackening the name of Rav Kook, but the Gera Rebbe, being a very, very sharp and brilliant person, had discounted most of it and wanted to see for himself what kind of being this Rav Kook is. And so he went to pay his respects. The Gerer Rebbe was attacked bitterly by the zealots, bitterly. He wasn't spared. But to show you the effect of propaganda, when the Gerer Rebbe first saw Rav Kook face to face and saw this picture in front of him, he whispered to his nephew, who was also a Rebbe next to him, he says, "Et Kook tachos v'yayere shemayim." He looks like a real pious Jew. He had expected to see a kind of man completely shaven with a white collar. He didn't know what to expect after all that he had been told. You can appreciate what he had to go through. And despite it all, Rav Kook was unmoved, and he never lost his sense of humor. In his last days, when he was on his deathbed, he was asked to send out a special kol kore, a special letter to the Jews of Lithuania to help the JNF, the Jewish National Fund. And he wrote a very powerful letter, and his secretary said, "Rebbe, maybe you ought to rethink it." He said, "Why?" He said, "On the basis of this letter, they're going to accuse you of being a Zionist." So Rav Kook began to laugh. He said, "You know, God too is a Zionist. He is Baruch Ata Hashem HaBocher B'Tzion. He likes Zion, and we have to imitate God." He said, "I have no choice. If God is a Zionist, I'm a Zionist too." It was the mark of his character that he never held a grudge against anyone. And on his last days, one of the people who wrote the most prolifically, the sharpest and vilest denunciations of Rav Kook, had a daughter who was sick, and he was told that Rav Kook has the keys to the best doctors in Vienna. So he came to him and says, "I have to ask you a favor." Rav Kook didn't recognize this anonymous antagonist, and he didn't tell him his name. He refused to tell him who he is. He said, "I must have a favor, but I can't tell you who I am." He said, "Why not?" He said, "Because I did terrible things to you." He says, "Did you do this and this and the other thing?" He said, "Yes." He says, "So what? A Jew needs help. Why shouldn't I help you?" He says, "Forget about it. You never did a thing to me." He gave him the letter, and as he left, he says, "Come back for a moment." He said, "Look, I know that you're going to Vienna. You're a poor man." He put his hand in his pocket and gave him a whole bunch of bills. He said, "This is my loan to you. You should be able to take your daughter and get her healed and come back in good health." This is a man who had blackened his name all over Europe and all over Palestine. And yet he had the bigness of character to take it with a sense of humor. He wanted, above all, to have shalom. Shalom, where peace became for him a primary principle. It is difficult to emphasize how much it meant to him. He taught that it was a halachic principle too. Rabbi Zevin, who was the editor of the Encyclopedia Talmudit, tells of attending a shalosh shudis in the summer of 1934, a year before he died, in which he spoke of shalom and milchama. I'll give it to you very briefly. It's a beautiful idea. In the priesthood, there were several offices. There was the Kohen Gadol, the high priest. There was the Sagan Kohen, the assistant of the high priest. Several offices. All of these went over Biyerusha, inheritance, from father to son, from father to son. There was another office called Meshuach Milchama, the anointed for war. It means the chaplain, that when the Jewish people went to war, this Kohen, which was a very high office, he was the chaplain and would speak and encourage the people. This was the only office that was not inherited, but had to be reappointed every time. And Rav Kook explained, because he said, war, even when it has merit, serves only an ephemeral, a temporary function. It only helps us achieve peace in a greater measure. Otherwise, it has no right to exist. Therefore, it's a passing phenomenon. It can't last. It can't endure. Peace endures forever. Peace is the normal station of mankind. Therefore, since war is non-enduring, how can you bequeath it as an inheritance? Therefore, it does not go over Biyerusha. It does not go from father to son, because it isn't anything really. War doesn't really exist. Peace does exist, and the function of a Kohen is shalom, because the Kohen had to institute peace amongst the people. Therefore, this does go Biyerusha. The stories about Rav Kook's phenomenal love of Israel became part of Jewish legends even while he was yet alive. I'll give you some of them, which are the choicest, I believe, but there are many, many more. One of the zealots said, accused him of being friendly with the left. And Rav Kook said, "Yes, I agree. But you know, I put my tefillin on my left hand too. Therefore, I'm friendly with the left." A Jew from Denver once came to him and complained bitterly about the Chilul Shabbos. He said, "Rav Kook, wherever I go in Yerushalayim, I see people, especially in the kibbutzim, I see people desecrating the Sabbath, and they eat tarfus. What's going on in this country? How can you stand it? He said, where did you say you come from? He said, Denver. He said, Denver, tell me, what kind of city is Denver? He said, oh, Rabbi, it's a beautiful city, right in the middle of the mountains, clear air, the most marvelous city in the whole world. He said, really? He said, you know, I had heard it's a city of terribly sick people. It's a city where everyone is a cripple. Wherever you go, you meet consumptives and tuberculars. And I said, Rabbi, you don't understand. Denver is such a beautiful city with such a wonderful climate that the sick people come to us to get healed. He said, then that's the story with Eretz Yisrael. It's a wonderful, holy country. And if you see people who are Mechalalei Shabbos, they come here to find spiritual healing. That's why you find so many people here. It's an international hospital for the Jewish people. He had a conversation with the Gerer Rebbe when he met him. And the Gerer Rebbe wanted to test this Rav Kook. And he said to him, what do you say to all the terrible desecration of the principles of the Torah? And Rav Kook said merely this, Rebbe, on the way to my home from the Kosel Ma'arovi, you passed a valley. Those of you who have been to Jerusalem remember, I'm sure, the valley of Hinnom, Gei Hinnom. In that valley, that's where we get the word Gehenna, or hell, from. In that valley, said Rav Kook, in ancient days, our ancestors used to offer up their children into the arms of the Moloch, the idol, to be burnt. He said, you know, Rebbe, they no longer do it. So why complain? We've improved a great deal in the course of the centuries. When someone complained that the young Jews are not putting on tefillin, he said, well, even those who don't lay tefillin lay bricks on the Holy Land, and that too is a great mitzvah. When someone said to him, this is the most famous of all perhaps, the Gerer Rebbe, who said, don't we need more holiness in this country? This is Eretz Yisrael. Here we need more holiness than elsewhere. He replied with a famous parable. He said that the Holy of Holies in the temple was such a holy place that only one person in the world was permitted to enter it, the high priest, the Kohen Gadol. And even he was not permitted to enter except on the holiest day of the year, Yom Kippur, after he had gone through all the preparations of purification. And yet if something was broken in that chamber, workmen would be called and no one would ask for their religious credentials. They would come in with their big boots with mud on their feet and with sawdust and dirt all over the place. No one bothered to ask them because they came to build it, he said. We too, if we had a completely built holy land that was holy, you could ask such questions. But the Chalotzimua here, they are the working men who are building the Kodesh HaKadoshim, and therefore you can have no complaint about them. And then finally, when the Gerer Rebbe said to him, aren't you confusing people by your over-friendship with the irreligious, by showing them so much love for no obvious reason? He said, the Talmud tells us we are not permitted to practice sinas chinam, unnecessary hatred. He said, I would rather be guilty of ahavas chinam than sinas chinam. I would rather be guilty of unnecessary love than unnecessary hatred. And interestingly, when the Gerer wrote home about his experiences with Rav Kook, he wrote, and I'm translating to you from the letter with just a bit of abbreviation, Rav Kook is a man who is great in Torah and unusual in character. His love for Zion and Israel is so great that it sometimes interferes with his clear judgment. When I complain to him that he is too friendly to these heretics, that he extends his hand to the sinner, he answered very simply, I merely imitate God, because about God we say in the Ne'ilah service in Yom Kippur, Atah no sein yod la poshim, you extend your hand to the sinners. If God shakes hand with the sinners, so do I. I am friendly with them too. And yet, we must not think that because of this tremendous love and generosity and open-mindedness, that Rav Kook was open-minded to the point of being non-discriminating and not having any opinions. Lionel Trilling, the great English critic, once said that sometimes people are so open-minded their brains fall out. Rav Kook could not be accused of that. He had love, but it was not an uncritical love, not a blind love. And when he felt that there had to be a protest, he protested, of course, in his own way. Let me give you an example by turning to page 8. Well, let me summarize this. What had happened is, You can read it as I talk. What happened is that Eliezer ben Yehuda, the famous lexicographer and author, actually the father of modern Hebrew, had written an article. He was one of the Ugandists, one of those who wanted to build the homeland in Uganda rather than in Israel and Palestine. In his argument against the Zionist, he was a Uganda Zionist, said that we, our modern generation, have turned our back on the Torah. We have turned our... Let me read to you the exact language. These are the exact words. People who have themselves turned their backs on our past reproach others for doing the same thing. He referred to the Orthodox as those who seek sins, those who look for avarice in others. And Rav Kook said that if this man had spoken on his own behalf to say that I turned my back on the past, I wouldn't say a word. But if he speaks in the name of a generation of the entire Jewish people, there I cannot remain silent. And as Rav Kook says it, with all my love for studying and teaching the foundations of our beliefs, I am far from wanting to force my opinion on any person, which is unthinkable anyway in our days. Therefore, if the editor of the Hashkafah, Ben Yehuda, were to state these things as his private opinion, it would never occur to me to debate with him. But now that he has mentioned these things in the name of the community, which of course includes our young people here in the land of Israel, it is impossible to pass over it in silence. Ben Yehuda took the chastisement, and he never lost, despite the criticism, never lost his love for the Rav. And in fact, we have letters in which Ben Yehuda, in compiling his dictionary, sent this great philologist, sent questions or shailos to Rav Kook, asking his advice in formulating new words for the growing Hebrew language. Now, Ahavas Eretz Yisrael, Ahavas Yisrael, and now Ahavas Hashem. The Ahavas Yisrael we discussed above, as we mentioned, is not purely emotional. It is based on something else. And here we come to a difficult but terribly important point. And that is that the love of Israel must be based upon a special divine quality in the collective character of the people. I think perhaps those of us who have been exposed to Western learning more than to traditional Jewish terminologies in this respect, the philosophies of Halevi and the Kabbalah, would perhaps recognize this more in the framework of the Jungian philosophy, the Swiss psychoanalyst Jung, who speaks of a collective consciousness. Except here we speak not in psychological, but more in spiritual terms. Rav Kook says there are two facets to the collective quality of our people. One is called segula. By segula, Rav Kook means the innate character. The other element is bechira, the voluntary free will choice of doing good or evil. Now, I may have a very good character, and yet, despite my basically good character, I may opt for an evil way. I may fall into temptation. I maybe have a harsher character, but train myself to opt for a better way of life. Usually, bechira, my choice, reflects segula, my innate character. Yet, both are distinct from each other. The segula of Am Yisrael, the segula of the Jewish people, according to Kook, is completely pure, light, and holy. The segula, the innate character, is undefiled. Turn to page 4 for a moment. Will someone read? The bottom of the page.
Physical and spiritual character of its race gave it its religious strength and potency, which it did not obtain by its own free choice, and which no wrong choice can gainsay. Free will has, of course, a great function regarding national character. A good choice can enhance and refine it, and express it in a perfect and worthy manner. An evil, lowly choice can darken the light of the innate character and sully its brightness, dulling the heart to the spiritual wealth hidden in the light of the soul. But this dullness of heart and darkening of the light cannot last forever. The innate character is assured of its continued existence and its arousal to life once again.
In other words, not in other words, in his own words, there is a basic character. This character of the Jew possesses in itself, innately, a divine quality, a love of God. So that the love of Israel, the rationale for Ahavas Yisrael, is that it is a faith in Israel's goodness. I love a Jew because of what is divine within the Jew. He himself may be a scoundrel, but the fact of his scoundrelness, as it were, his rascality, is a result of his bechira, his incidental choice. Innately, he reflects a divine quality. There's a nitzas alakam imal. It is that in him which I love, therefore do I love all of him. In other words, if you break it down logically to its essentials, what is the love of Israel? A form of what? A form of the love of God. I love what is godly in my fellow Jew. My fellow Jew, by virtue of his Jewishness, is a godly being. Therefore, because of that, I love him. Of course, mind you, when Cook speaks in this language, he does not exclude all of mankind. By no means. But he is interested now in developing a philosophy of nationalism within Judaism. And therefore, he does not speak of the others. He concentrates on this. Therefore, for instance, Rav Kook believes that man as such is innately good. More than that, he believes, this is an interesting introduction to his commentary on the prayer book. What does prayer mean, says Rav Kook? And those of you, I don't want to read the whole thing, on page 3 you can find it later. What does prayer mean? Prayer does not mean that I initiate a new state of being in the presence of God. Prayer, incidentally, does not mean merely asking for something or just praising. It means the total awareness of the human soul, human personality, that he stands before Kutcha Brichu in the presence of God and as it were, communicates with him in a feeling that goes beyond mere words. Now, this state of being in prayer, how do I create it? How do I suddenly put myself before God? What is Rav Kook's answer? That the soul is always in a state of prayer. There's the tefillah ha-matmedet shel ha-neshama. The tefillah of the soul is masmedes, or matmedet in Sephardit. It is constant. My soul always prays. That which in me, which is godly, which is spiritual, is always, as it were, in communion with God. The trouble is I don't know it, because I'm not always aware of my soul. What happens in the moments when I daven, as it should be done, when I daven with kavana, with feeling, with intensity? I merely allow my inner self to express itself. I stop interfering with myself. That is prayer. So it is based upon the fact that man inwardly is a praying individual. He's a godly individual. He's a divine individual. Not divine, but godly, godlike individual. Therefore, this falls in line with the idea that the collective quality of Israel also expresses this relationship to God, the element of segula. The origin of this theory, again, is in the Hasidic background of Rav Kook, especially the Chabad background. An interesting point, which is both philosophical and folksy at the same time. You know that one of the important statements we make every day is the Shema, correct? Now, after the verse of the Shema, what do we say? V'yahavta es Adonai Elohecha b'chol levavcha b'chol nafshecha b'chol ma'odecha. What does that mean? Basically, we have to love God. Is this a commandment? Yes, the answer is that those who count, we have 613 commandments, do we not? Those thinkers, those rabbonim, the Talmidei Chachamim who created the list of 613 and enumerated them, count Ahavas Hashem, the love of God, as one of the commandments. But Jewish philosophers have asked a very simple question. How can you command the love of God? Can you command anyone to love anyone else? Is love a thing that is subject to command? Obviously, and I think parents of teenage children will know that very well. You can't command to love. You can command a daughter to go out with a certain young man. You can't command it to love him. Love is a thing which it comes from within. Either it's there or it's not there. But you can't direct someone to have love. How then can the Torah command me, a mitzvah means a command me to love God? Either I do or I don't. So the Tanya, the first the originator of the movement of Chabad Hasidism, answers as follows. It is something which I have mentioned before in the center, which to me is a very important principle. That every Jew, we're speaking only of Jews now, is born with an ahava tivis umesuteris, with a natural concealed love of God within him. We are born theophiles. We are born lovers of God. Man is created in his natural state, in his natural healthy state, as a religious being. Just as we speak of man as a homo sapiens, in a natural state, man is intellectual, he's intelligent. Does it mean everyone you know is intelligent? Of course not. Some people use their intelligence, and perhaps most people don't. But the race as such, the species as such, is a rational one. Rav Kook would maintain, with Chabad, with the whole Hasidic movement, and in this sense, all of Judaism, I believe, that man is a homo religiosus. He is by nature a religious being. He is born that way. He is born with an inner intuitive relationship to his creator. The point is that sometimes he manages to express it in his state of health. At other times, it becomes shriveled up, dried, encrusted, and covered up with all kinds of moss, of indifference, of busyness, or whatever it might be. But man in his normal state is religious. Therefore, the commandment, thou shalt love the Lord thy God, does not mean, I want you to put in love where none existed before. It means you already love God. All I ask of you is stop interfering with it. Thou shalt love the Lord thy God means take your mind away from your business and from your temptations and your passions and your trivialities that becloud your mind and your heart. Make it free so that the natural soul will express itself and you will become what you naturally were meant to be, namely a religious being. This is the ahava tivis umesuteris, the natural concealed love within man's heart. To summarize, Rav Kook's vision of God and Israel, Israel meaning land and people, is one of three powerful loves with which his heart was intoxicated. More accurately, it was only one love, which expressed itself in many ways, because they are derived one from the other. Thus, because of the innate inner love of God within Israel, there is a segula, or a kedushas haklal, the collective sanctity of the people. Because there is this segula, this innate love of God, there follows logically the principle of ahavas Yisrael, the love of Israel. And because we have love of Israel, we have ahavas Eretz Yisrael. So the three things we talked about really are one. The first built on the second built on the third. Because of Ahavas Hashem, there is Ahavas Yisrael. Because of Ahavas Yisrael, there is Ahavas Eretz Yisrael. Today, too often, these three loves are fragmented and disunited. There are lovers of God who often are lax in their love of Israel, meaning fellow Jews, and their love of the state of Israel. There are philanthropic Jews who love their fellow Jews, but who lack their love in their love of God and in their love of the Holy Land. And there are Zionists and Israeli patriots and citizens who are powerful in their Ahavas Eretz Yisrael, but are sorely lacking in their Ahavas Hashem, and even in their Ahavas Yisrael, their love of other Jews throughout the world. Our ideal ought to be, and if this lecture has at least inspired the slightest aspiration towards such an ideal, it was worthwhile, to try to unite all three organically. For even as God, Israel, and Torah are one, Kutcha Brichu Yisrael V'Araisa Chadhu, so must the Ahava, the love for God, the love for Israel, and the love for the Holy Land, be one too. We must unite them, make them one organic unity, achieve a brilliant and luminous oneness of all these three precious loves of which we spoke. Then will we be able to fulfill the Talmud's immortal teaching that Kol Yisrael Arevim Ze Laze, which is translated and literally means every Jew is responsible for another. But as the Hasidic masters taught us, the word arevim means not only responsible, it also means sweet. Kol Yisrael arevim ze lezeh. Alle Yidden seinen zis. Endet zum Zweiten. All Jews are sweet, one to another. No greater love hath any people.